Welcome back to FinTech Lab, our podcast from the National University of Singapore FinTech Lab, where we talk about all things FinTech and everything related to that. So welcome back, Nicholas. It's been a while, a few months since our last episode, but we're back here again.
Of course. So great to be back. And we're talking about an interesting paper today that looks at how we all have heard the phrase that data is oil, but this is a paper that will discuss how emerging companies might be able to compete with some of the big moats that large established players have in their acquisition of data to use for all the sorts of services we like to use in our everyday lives.
Yeah. As I was reading this, I really thought, wow, this is really an inherent problem that we really haven't talked about very deeply. Right. Globally, you know, we want to set up hubs for entrepreneurship and innovation. Right. We want, for example, Singapore wants to be for AI and fintech. And we want to encourage new startups, entrepreneurship, working on these things. And we're doing that in our lab as well. But one of the inherent problems, I think, facing all of these startups is that they may have great ideas, deep tech ideas about new machine learning models, new AI models for doing, you know, number crunching or providing better recommendations, better advice, you know, using AI for doing all these things. But really, you know, as a startup, you start off with ideas about how to process data, but you don't have the data itself. You kind of work in that abstract kind of idea space where, okay, you know, if we had this kind of data, we would have this nice way of processing the data, creating recommendations, creating predictions that could offer immense value to potential customers. And that's where a lot of the startups start off. But then they hit a barrier, a huge wall, which is, where am I going to get the data? And collecting the data organically is going to be extremely costly. It's going to take a long time. And so, you know, we can think about, oh, can we acquire data through other data acquisition platforms? And, you know, it can be thought, okay, that's a simple solution, but is it really that simple? Right. So we're going to talk about this paper recently published in Information Systems Research. The title is Algorithms to the Rescue: Market Mechanisms for Consensual Trading of Unbiased Individual Data. Our authors are Brian Burkhead, Ashkan Eshki, Ram Gopal, Human Hidaji, and Raymond Patterson. Authors are from a lot of different institutions. A very fascinating paper, which really talks about if we go to like data platforms that have access to, let's say, consumers or patient, you know, people who have sensitive data that other data acquirers like these startups may be interested to have, may need to, you know, train their machine learning models and whatnot. And, you know, they get paid for supplying that data. And most of the kind of the pricing mechanisms that we currently have for getting people to share their data on these platforms would produce biased data sets or biased samples. What do we mean by that, Nicholas?
So for those of you who have a background in machine learning or just have been around data science before, I'm sure you've heard of the problems around of biased data. We've seen it crop up again and again in the aspects of fairness, where if there's one population that might be larger or more represented in the data set, then the algorithm that's trained on this data might perform better on this population. A famous example of this would be some computer vision algorithms from Amazon that were trained on different faces for image recognition. And it turned out that it was able to recognize white male faces better than black female faces. So this is just one small example of how a biased training set can affect an algorithm's performance on different sets of data. But this doesn't only apply to individuals as well. We can also think of this in the fintech space or the finance space. Other ways that it affects people's lives is if you're trying to, at least in the case of the USA, understand what the cost of different medical procedures are. Hospitals and insurance companies often hide this information, is held in a very private manner. And so if you are a company that's trying to provide better health insurance to people at a better cost, at a better quality per cost, getting the kind of information that the hospitals may be reluctant to provide would be very difficult and very hard for you to spin up your startup to bring this essential service to people. And so you might have some hospitals from some cities cities that are much more open about the data that they're sharing, and other hospitals in other cities might be much more closed. And so your predictions of how much different procedures are costing might be wildly inaccurate depending on the geography that you're in.
Yeah. But why do we see bias though? Why does bias? We know the problem of biased data, but why do different, the extent mechanisms for remunerating, the data subjects for disclosing their data. Why does that inherently lead to bias in the sample?
Well, as the paper argues, it is that there might be people with different levels of differential privacy. That is to say, there are people who are willing and ready to share their information, and other people who are more hesitant or less willing to share their information. And because of this, the information that's very freely given will populate most of the sample of whoever is collecting this data, whereas people who are more hesitant to give their information, it might be very necessary to get these people to have fully representative data, but you might have to somehow compensate them more for the extra hesitancy or extra trepidation they have to provide this information. Is that what you're thinking?
So basically, I think the idea is that people value their data, personal data, and the valuation really depends on individuals' privacy concerns, right? Mm. The higher the privacy concern, if I'm very highly privacy concerned, then I would think, oh, my data is worth a lot more. And for example, if the data acquirer or the data platform were to set a fixed price, for instance, for sharing the data. And so if a company came along and said, oh, we're willing to offer you X or $5 for each individual, that could be 30 cents, could be whatever X amount. And then you would get everybody that had valuation below that X, but nobody above that X. But if there's some correlation between that valuation, the privacy concern level, with the sampling aspects, then naturally, if you cut off at that threshold, you're going to get a biased sample. And inherently, with a biased sampling approach, your estimates of whatever you're interested in, right? Or it could be simple statistics as people's heights, right? So if you have, if taller people are more privacy concerned than shorter people, and you only get short people, the average height would be much smaller than the actual average height that you want to estimate. And so you can apply that to more complex machine learning models. If you have a biased sample, obviously your model training will be inefficient and it will be biased, and you're not going to get the right kind of, the outputs or the outcomes that you need. So again, like this kind of fixed price creates this inherent bias. But there's other more sophisticated approaches there too, complete centralized optimization, where everybody or the data provider, the data platform actually uses, information or data that they have about their data subjects that can, correlate with privacy concerns, try to estimate the level of privacy concern and compensate people, differentially, right? Give people different amounts based on the different privacy concerns. And wouldn't that be a solution? Why would that solution also create bias?
So the centralized approach has several issues with it. And when we talk about centralized approach, we mean that if the platform is trying to estimate the different privacy concerns or the different amounts that it would have to pay people for their information being used by the model, or we don't always have to conceptualize as paying. Oftentimes you'll see if you go to the supermarket, if you use a club membership, or in Singapore, we have something called a U card that essentially tracks your data from store to store. You get a discount from what you pay or some amount of cash back. So it doesn't have to purely be structured as a upfront compensation. But if the platform is going to be paying different people different amounts in line with what it thinks the privacy concerns or the cost to the user to give up this data is, this creates a few different problems. Perhaps the biggest of which is that if the centralized planner in this case is able to accurately predict people's trepidation or cost to them to give up their data, this implies that the platform already has a relatively robust amount of data in order to accurately estimate these costs. And so it doesn't really solve the problem that we're thinking of people trying to, if they don't have a lot of data in the first place, get the representative data they need to even answer these sorts of questions. Secondarily, the platform might inaccurately estimate the privacy concerns of the user and give them a price or a discount to compensate them for their privacy, that's not in line with what the user's actually looking at. So the scheme that's brought up by these authors in the paper that they recommend is not setting a fixed price by the platform itself, but eliciting the privacy concerns or how important privacy is to the individual users, and then creating something of an auction model so that the market will dynamically price what this data is actually worth and try to give an incentive to people to accurately report their privacy concerns, such that if they, in fact, are trying to get the most amount of discounts that they possibly can, they wouldn't price their data too high, because they would actually sell their data less. And if they, again, were very privacy conscious, they wouldn't set their price too low, because then their data would be sold quite a bit. Would you like to add on, Jungpil, to this understanding of how the auction mechanism is helping to solve some of the problems in the current system?
So the marketing mechanism that these authors propose, that's being rolled out by a startup, and it's called random sampling of rolling pairs, so RSP for short, right? Random sampling of rolling pairs. And the intuition is that if you have the whole data population, your data set, you create pairs, you sort them according to your understanding of their privacy concerns, from most concern to least concern, and then you pair them up. So person one with person two, then person two with person three with person four. And then each data subject, and we're assuming that each data subject has the ability to value or put a price on their data. And then you're going to have the rolling pairs. You're going to run an auction between these two and see who, and use the Vickrey pricing mechanism. And in auction theory, the Vickrey mechanism has been shown to be incentive compatible, meaning being truthful is always the best strategy. So you are rewarded for being truthful and you get the best outcomes. And so, if you think, I can milk, the data purchaser and, try to get more money, even though my data might be worth $5, but I'm going to say, I think it's worth $10, you will never win. And so the auction mechanism ensures that you are going to be more truthful and that, you're going to state your actual valuation instead of overblowing it. And then that auction mechanism, you would do, the rolling pairs, each of the rolling pairs, you do the auction. And at the end, you get the most efficient, most cost-effective overall price, and you get an unbiased sample. It's a very clever mechanism. It does have computational costs, but when we think about ad network that run millions or hundreds of millions of ad auctions at each ad request, or like in each day, it doesn't seem like it's a huge computational burden, and it's possible to actually run these auctions. Computationally, it doesn't seem like it's a problem, but theoretically, it provides these nice properties of incentive compatibility. You will eventually be able to acquire an unbiased sample, which is kind of the objective of the original data collection exercise.
Even just as a small point to add on to that, there's, of course, these fears in the world about over-surveillance, or we're entering the age of surveillance. In a sense, because this is one mechanism that both the users are compensated, so that obviously they're informed that their data is being used, they're compensated for the data, but also getting a representative or unbiased sample with as few data points as possible, you're also actually reducing the amount of over-surveillance of the people who, in a traditional manner, you would just try to collect as much data as possible in order to fill out your sample with any sparse areas. If there's some people who are very odd, you would want enough samples of them. And this way, you could gather, in a sense, less information, but it'd be the most useful information that you would need. So this would also alleviate some of our fears of potentially over-surveillance. But Jungpil, do we think that there's any particular, although this model, of course, is very scoped to answer a particular problem, and I think it does a very good job of answering how to get very unbiased samples in an efficient way that data providers, that is to say the individual users, are aware and are not just given consent, but are compensated for their data. Are there any shortcomings or limitations we see of applying this information to the real world?
So I think that's the point that kind of bothered me as I was reading this paper. It sounded too good to be true. So if a very simple mechanism that's computationally efficient, sufficiently efficient, can actually solve this data sampling bias problem so easily, why haven't we done so already? Or are some of the assumptions a little too strict or too strong? So I've been thinking about, is this really deployable, or do all these assumptions check out? So my biggest concern is with consumers or the data providers, the data subjects' ability to value their data, It's not pricing of data or information has always been theoretically and also in practice a very challenging concern. So it could be related to how I feel about how much my data is worth. But at the same time, that's very uncertain and it's very difficult to come up with, even if there is an incentive compatible approach to data elicitation. My valuation, it's good to be truthful, but I don't know what the truth is in the first place. So in the presence of such uncertainty, will this method actually work? And will we still be able to minimize or reduce the bias in the sampling? That's one concern. I think that's a huge concern and one where we need a lot more insight, conceptual development with respect to what is the economics of data or pricing of data, of the information. I think it's very challenging because the same piece of data, it's not like anything else that we've seen. It's not like you have a gold bar and you say, how much is it worth? Or it's not a tangible artifact. Valuing intellectual property has always been a very challenging concern. And because knowledge or information has the properties of a public good, not a public good, but it's not a private good. So you can't exclude others from consuming it. And once you consume it, it doesn't deplete. So if you have an apple and you eat it, then nobody else can eat it. So that's kind of the property of an economic good. So once I know something, I can use it and reuse it. When I sell you something, it's not just at that transaction how much it's worth, but once it gets out, then it's out there.
It could be even resold and just copied and pasted.
Right? And so how do we create pricing models for such an asset, for such a good? And those are some of the issues that complicate the pricing of data. And I've been thinking about this problem for quite a long time. I have no answers. It's just very complex. It rests on an assumption that we can kind of accurately value our data and whether those assumptions, if violated, would severely hinder the efficiency and effectiveness of this proposed RSP method. That's kind of the question that I had. Did you have any related limitations or questions?
That was actually the single biggest concern as well. And I'll add a couple of points onto it. In some sense, how I would phrase it in my own jargon is this idea of bounded rationality. Because the model is using this idea of economic agents, of course, they do have an experiment with survey respondents, but who are real life people. In the real life, as you said, individuals have a very limited ability to accurately estimate the cost to themselves of giving up this information or the benefit that they should ask for it. I think there's one example that is actually very salient in the recent news, which is that if you might have seen headlines, this AI company called Anthropic agreed to pay $1.5 billion to authors of books that it pirated to train its AI model. And the authors who were getting money from this settlement got about $3,000 each, regardless of how important or foundational or derivative their books were. So there's a uniform payment across authors. So I think we will see, as AI becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, this need to pay different people different amounts of money if you actually are going to pay the people who provide training data relative to the importance of their data. And I do think this auction model is a good way if you are an author or if you are a publisher that owns this author's work. This is a way for the publisher to try to maximize his profits and try to set good prices for things in hopes that it can sell the book to the AI companies. But as we talked about, for individuals, you and me, if we have to kind of think about every time we enter a website, how to price our information, you don't have the bandwidth to accurately model this. One thing I thought was interesting from other papers I've read on privacy in the past was this idea that informed consent might not be enough, because if you read these terms and conditions, there's so much noise and you just try to get through it. You just click accept to the cookies or accept to the terms. This is actually not the best way for people to feel good about giving consent. But on the other hand, if you have some kind of third party who will either be delegated in some sense the decision-making authority for the user or acts as some kind of intermediary for the users, this intermediary, this third party, might have the bandwidth to accurately look out for its users in conversation with the people who are asking for their data. And one example that we saw that this actually worked was the Apple Store. The apps on the Apple Store used to take all sorts of people's data with kind of in shady ways that people didn't know. But as this concerns became greater and greater and greater, Apple started throttling the kinds of data that could be taken and started to streamline the ways that the terms and conditions could be asked of to the users, so you have less cognitive overload. So I think that this model can be potentially ported to the auction model that we're discussing here, where there's some way of streamlining or having a third party who's acting as the agent that has enough bandwidth to accurately look out for the best interest of the users. That might be one way to do it. Of course, you might bring back the centralization issue, but this might be one way to implement it in the real world.
I think that that's a very good point. And I think, to me at least, kind of pointing or articulating kind of what we really need to figure out moving forward. There's a lot of different aspects. One is like we do need better economic theories about data valuation. So that's one thing. And if we did, then like some of these approaches would work, right? So we have to tackle the assumptions underlying some of these market mechanisms, right? The other is, you know, when we talk about, you know, the non-rivalry or the, you know, the data not being completely consumed, or you can resell data and all these things. There's a lot of technical approaches that have been being proposed. And so you're not, for example, homomorphic encryption, differential privacy, all these kinds of technical approaches to sharing insights from a data without sharing the data itself. And, you know, having additional, you know, developments in these areas, and these are very complex areas, having additional development in these areas would allow us to actually share insights that you want. Like you can learn whatever you need without the need for the sharing or the sale of actual data values. And that would be privacy preserving by design. It highlights the different directions for ongoing research, the needs for doing that. And I think it's only going to get more and more needed. Needs going to become more dire as our society moves towards, at least the technological landscape moves towards a lot of these AI platforms where there's a lack of transparency about what data is being used, like copyrighted data, individuals' data just on the internet, whatever that AI crawler from OpenAI or Anthropic might gather. You know, they've become less and less transparent about what kind of data sources that they use to train their models. And having a lot more clarity, regulatory clarity, economic clarity about how these can and should be used will provide a better environment for all involved, right? Not just the AI companies that are using this data, but they do want to use this responsible manner. So I think there's a need for a lot of research. And this article that we just reviewed gives us an opportunity to think about what's important and what the next steps are, where we should focus our research efforts. So I think that's been a good conversation, and we'll ponder on these issues and hopefully can have some of our students and the aspiring entrepreneurs can mentor them in terms of, you know, these are these problems, help them try to focus their energy and effort on critical problems that we need to solve in order for the future of not just AI, but fintech and all this to become reality. What do you think?
Excellent. Yeah, I think that we definitely can mentor people, and we are training our fintech ecosystem here in Singapore, and hopefully listeners all over the world can potentially look into this model to understand how they can get data in an unbiased way, train their models, and make their algorithms behave in a representative manner towards all people, and also act in a way that's going to fairly compensate the users of the data. When we look at places like Europe with GDPR, there's this trend towards data portability and having your data that you clearly give consent. And so these kinds of models are definitely ways that we can move towards a world where people are not feeling like their data is always being taken from them, but rather it's up to you to decide if you want to give it away and if it's actually useful to these AI companies that are sucking it up, then you can be fairly compensated for it. So I think this is definitely something that we can try to build into our wider discussions around fairness, around data, and even around machine learning classes in general of how to get representative data in a fair manner.
Okay, yeah. With that, I think we'll end it here. This gap that we have had a few months, I will try to come back a bit sooner. Hopefully we can continue this conversation soon. So thank you, and I'll see you again in a little while.
Thank you. See you all soon.